From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, a skeptic's view of the paranormal. But here's what's happening. And you probably have heard this by now, but the United States has launched a military strike on a Syrian government target in retaliation for their chemical weapons attack on civilians earlier in the week. On President Donald Trump's orders, U.S. warships launched between 55 and 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles at a Syrian government airbase where the warplanes that carried out the apparent chemical attacks were based. The strikes are the first direct military action on the U.S. that we have taken against the leadership of Syrian President Bashar Assad in the country's six-year civil war, and represent a substantial escalation of the U.S. military campaign in the region, which could be interpreted by the Syrian government as an act of war. And of course, the Russians have not really responded yet, but apparently there were Russians at the base, and we will have to check and see what is happening there. They apparently were forewarned about the attack. I don't know how much time we gave them. Now, the Tomahawk missiles cost $1.59 million apiece. If we launched the 59, that's $94 million in missiles. They travel at the speed of 550 miles an hour. They have a range of about 800 miles to 1,500 miles. They used to be tipped with nukes. Some of them were. Not anymore. They're all conventional missiles. They carry about 1,000 pounds of high explosives. Formerly, they were made by McDonnell Douglas, then General Dynamics. Now the Raytheon Corporation makes them. Dr. Jerome Corsi is with us to get his reaction to this truly remarkable attack tonight, Jerry.
Well, it is remarkable, George. I think it's a clear departure from what the Obama administration was doing. And then here you've got President Trump, who came out and said he was very upset about this, and then within hours there's a military response. And you know, we had many red lines drawn by President Obama that were never reacted to. They've just passed. And this is a new message, I think. Basically, there's new sheriff in town, and that President Obama, you know, is not in office any longer, and President Trump is going to take action. Military action when he sees a threat like he has in Syria. It's very, very dramatically different than we had just a few months ago.
It sure is. Thank you, Jerry. And of course, in the past, Donald Trump, citizen Donald Trump, would send tweets about President Obama saying, do not attack Syria. Don't do it. So there was a change of tone. And the reason why the president changed his tone now was because of the pictures and the video he saw of the chemical attacks, primarily the children that he saw killed during this horrible situation. Now, while all this was going on, the president is in Florida with the Chinese president talking about North Korea. Let's check in with Howard Bloom. Howard, what a night, huh?
What a night, what a week, one of the most dangerous weeks you and I will ever live through, and Donald Trump finally did something right. He set a meeting with China's leader Xi Jinping just as tensions are escalating around North Korea's nuclear warheads and missiles, the warheads and missiles that North Korea is developing to nuke American cities. What's more, Trump's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has a visit set early next week to Russia. Now, why are these diplomatic initiatives with China and Russia essential moves? Because today, as you just reported, Donald Trump ordered an attack on an airbase at Shayrat outside of Homs in Syria. And at Trump's instructions, our military hit the Syrian base with, as you said, somewhere in the neighborhood between 43 and 60 Tomahawk missiles. But Trump did this in a way that hopefully would not trigger a conflict with the country that's using Syria's airbases for its warplanes, Russia. Orders were apparently not to hit human beings or Russian assets. The Shayrat Air Base, as you reported, our military believes, is the one from which this week's chemical attack on the rebel province of Idlib was launched. If, in fact, the chemical carnage was an attack mounted by Syria and Russia. Now, let's step back a minute and look at the really big picture here. As I said, this week has been the most dangerous in your lifetime and mine. It's brought two nuclear options that have nothing to do with the Senate. Potential nuclear wars triggered by North Korea and Syria. And here's how it works. Alliances create chain reactions.
They do.
In 1914, alliances brought a war that no one expected and no one wanted. World War I, a war that killed 17 million people. And that can easily happen again, but this time with nuclear weapons and far higher death tolls. Right now, the two alliances dominate the world. One is NATO. The other has no name, but in that unnamed alliance, China is allied with North Korea and with Russia. Russia is allied with Iran and Syria, and North Korea is allied with Iran. So North Korea, Syria, Iran, Russia, and China are a chain. You yank one link in the chain, and you yank them all. Now, Russia reportedly has thousands of military personnel and planes in Syria carrying out bombing strikes. Many of these airstrikes are in hospitals, and the strikes are designed, George, to make life a living hell for the Syrian rebels, a hell without food, medicine, electricity, drinking water, or safety. In other words, these Russian and Syrian airstrikes are designed to motivate rebels and their families to flee Syria and to take up residence in foreign refugee camps where they have no weapons and where they are harmless. Now, back to what Donald Trump is doing right. Trump is doing something right by meeting with Xi Jinping before taking any unilateral military action in North Korea. He is right to try to cement a friendship with the dinner that he held tonight with Xi, Xi's wife, and with Trump's wife Melania at Mar-a-Lago. And hopefully, Trump's negotiations with Xi tomorrow will go well. Meanwhile, Trump is also right to send Rex Tillerson to Moscow. But so far, things are not going so well with Russia. In Russia's Putin-controlled news outlet, RT, Russian spokesman Dmitry Peskov complained that there is too little diplomatic talk with the Trump administrations. The Russians say that their planes and the planes of the Syrians did not use chemical weapons. They say that their planes hit a chemical weapons factory run by the rebels, and they call for the rush to judgment to stop. The Russians are calling for a UN investigation. I was at the UN today. With an Iranian television crew. The Russians are calling for a UN investigation to see who pulled the trigger, who actually used the chemical weapons. And RT, the Russian news outlet, is pointing out that in October, it's pointing out today, that in October of last year, Putin had a warning. He told a conference in Sochi the U.S. should stop brazenly blaming Russia for the situation in Syria, and Putin said the U.S., here's the hard part, may face an equally harsh response. In other words, American military strikes to punish Syria for using chemical weapons can rouse military retaliation from Russia, and unilateral American military action to take out North Korea's nukes and missiles could result in military retaliation from China. There is a simple bottom line. Use dinners at Mar-a-Lago and in Moscow to win others over to our side. Use carrots and sticks, but watch out for chain reactions that cause world wars.
Indeed. And Howard, I'm going to put you on hold because I may very well need you as we go into this hour. Just stay right where you are. In some other news, GlaxoSmithKline is recalling nearly 600,000 albuterol inhalers, folks. Three of the lots, FHA 2000 inhalers, have been voluntarily recalled due to potential issues with the delivery system. Could be bad for people who have asthma and other breathing issues as well. This is one of the saddest stories I've seen on the internet in a long time. An 11-year-old Michigan boy hanged himself after his 13-year-old girlfriend faked her own suicide as part of a manipulative social media prank. Katrina Gross of Marquette said her son, Tyson, died at a hospital in Ann Arbor after she found him trying to take his life. She said that she later learned that her son's suicide attempt was in response to a sick online joke. The shocking stunt was carefully coordinated between the teenage girl, whose name is being withheld, and her friends. How sad can that be? A woman fell off a bridge in Northern California while attempting to take a risky selfie in a restricted area. Folks, be careful when you take selfies. A Massachusetts man who had his hand cut off by a machete during a fight has had the hand reattached. And authorities say the suspect has been ordered held without bail, but the hand may work. Comedian legend and actor Don Rickles has died of kidney failure. Born in New York City, Rickles served in the U.S. Navy for 2 years during World War II before he found his fame He got his big break when he, in his insult comedy routine, began getting some attention from the chairman of the board, Frank Sinatra. He connected with Sinatra by chiding him during his show and eventually became the go-to comic of the Rat Pack. He made frequent appearances on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
I just was hanging around in the hall, and they said, Frank Sinatra's here. I've never met him, you know. And I get the chill.
You'll excuse us.
Certainly, certainly. Marco Mangananzo was hurt.
Marco Mangananzo.
Fombino Bombazzo. Two bullets in the head Thursday.
Don Rickles, dead at the age of 90 years old. I saw him in Las Vegas last year. Robert Davi, our friend, singer and actor, was his warm-up act. And then Rickles came out and did his show, and he was truly remarkable. Never missed a beat. A study that we reported on yesterday, the most stressed-out states. Number one is Alabama, because people are stressed out with not having access, they said, to mental health. They had low credit scores. They had the least sleep. Other states were Louisiana, Mississippi, West Virginia, Kentucky. Meanwhile, the less stressed out states were Minnesota, North Dakota, Iowa, and South Dakota, and Utah. So I thought we'd bring in our resident psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin, for a moment. Peter, how could you be stressed out over these factors?
George, I kind of got missed that. Which factor was they stressed out over?
Oh, they're stressed out over the lack of mental health abilities in the state and the low credit scores and no sleep. How does that cause that?
It's poverty, George. It's mostly poverty that affects all of those things. And Alabama is a very, very poor state. But I do want to defend it because it's among, in different studies, among the most charitable in the country, and it's got the top 10 in favorability for being a doctor. And I live in New York State, and it's the worst state for being a doctor. So, I mean, am I better off here or there? We've got more burdensome regulations in New York State. We got fewer doctors per population. Our hospitals are worse. So, you know, I don't think we should just go after any one state or another. I'd be better off in Alabama.
Yeah, I guess so. Peter, thanks so much. Dr. Peter Breggin. In a moment, we'll continue our discussion with Howard Bloom as we talk about the situation in Syria, where we launched tonight 59 Tomahawk missiles against an air base in Syria in retaliation to what apparently was Syrians bombing of civilians with chemicals, sarin gas, perhaps. In a moment, we'll continue our discussion with Howard Bloom here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're going to hold Howard Bloom over for just a little bit as we talk about the situation now in Syria. President Donald Trump, his first true big act as president in terms of a commander-in-chief, has ordered the United States Navy to fire off 59 Tomahawk missiles. These Tomahawk missiles all apparently struck their target. They're very accurate. They have a range of 800 miles to 1,500 miles, and they hit an air base in Syria, the air base that we believe was used to launch the gas attacks via jets on civilians and people in Syria. They've had a six-year civil war going on. This is the first time we have gotten involved militarily against the Assad regime directly. And let's bring in Howard again. Howard, how do you think this is going to unfold?
Well, let's look at the history for a minute. This is not a civil war. It never has been a civil war. It's a proxy war. It's a war between Iran and Saudi Arabia for control of the Middle East and for control of the entire Islamic world, which spans a 13,500-mile expanse, goes across Africa, all across Asia, everywhere from Nigeria to Aceh and Indonesia. The nature of it is a proxy war. I discussed this with Nancy Kissinger, Henry Kissinger's wife, at length, with Henry standing 4 feet away, and it is extremely frustrating to see how we've been conned into thinking that this is a civil war when it's not. The Iranians are supporting Bashar Assad, and George, they have 100,000 troops in Syria.
They sure do.
That's a serious commitment. And they are trying to reel in. They've had Bashar Assad as an ally for a long time, but they're trying to reel him in as a puppet, the way that they've turned Iraq into a puppet. The Saudis are scared to death. Remember, these are two different branches of Islam. The Saudis are Sunnis. The Iranians are Shiite. And they're two different races, if we're allowed to use that word anymore. The Arabs have been the supermen, the lords and masters of the Islamic Empire, ever since 1,400 years ago, when that empire started to rise from the Middle East. But the first territory that the Arabs conquered was the Persian Empire, which we know today as Iran. The Persians are not Arabs. And this difference between Shiites and Sunnis, between Persians and Arabs, has been festering for over 1,300 years now. And it's come to the surface with modern weapons, dangerous weapons, and with this mass alliance we were just talking about that goes all the way through Iran, Syria, Russia, China, and Korea. Iran gets its missile, or got an awful lot of its missile technology and its nuclear technology from North Korea. So when I say this is a chain, China, Russia, Syria, Iran, and North Korea, it's really a loop. It's just a big loop. So where does this go from here? We have to be extremely careful not to end up in a war with Russia.
That's a big danger here, Howard. It's the
World War I.
And what we don't know, apparently what they said today was that they notified Russia that we were going to do this, to give them time to move out any of their jets or any of their personnel or military that might be in Syria. Now, that seems strange to me, because they're going to tip off the Syrians, first of all, the minute you do that. But I have not heard of any Russian casualties because of these 59 Tommy Hawk missile attacks.
Well, the Russians are sort of playing it low-key. They're complaining about the lack of communication. The communication to them was too minimal. More important, remember, RT trotted out this old threat from Putin from October, any action we took could have really grave consequences. And they put that on their front page today. So we don't know what Russia's response is going to be. Tillerson, it would have been ideal if Tillerson had been in Russia yesterday, not next week, because the trip could always be canceled. But Tillerson's trip is extremely important. One of the advantages of what Donald Trump did today, taking military action, it's a warning to China that we're serious about North Korea, and that when we say that we may be forced to take unilateral action and that the door to negotiations is over, remember, we've been negotiating for an end to the nuclear program in North Korea for 10 or 15 years and arriving at agreements, and none of those agreements has been honored by North Korea. Any more than the nuclear agreement that we have with Iran is likely in the long run to be honored by Iran. We have to move with the carrot and the stick. We have to move with cautious diplomacy. Donald Trump charms people, even his enemies, even Al Gore. When Al Gore went to meet Donald Trump, he was utterly charmed. That charm is being used tonight on Xi Jinping. Either before or after the dinner, Donald Trump made a joke, and he said, well, I haven't really extracted any concessions out of Xi yet. Tomorrow is the real working event, and it focuses around a lunch, but Xi Jinping is only here for 24 hours. So Donald Trump has to work that magic.
He better. That's what he does best.
And he needs to work it on Vladimir Putin without coming across as Putin's lapdog, without coming across as Putin's puppet and his poodle. And that's a tricky one to pull off, but we need it now, because the last thing we want is a war that destroys our cities.
Exactly. Howard, thank you for being part of the program. I really appreciate it with our updates. We will, throughout the night tonight, monitor the situation of the 59 Tommy Hawks that have been launched against Syrian airbase. And any follow-up or reaction, we will have it for you first on Coast to Coast AM. When we come back in just a moment, we are going to be talking about the new Koreans. Michael Breen joins me. He is in South Korea live. We will talk with him about the situation in Korea, North Korea, and the South. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Quite a day, folks, as we continue monitoring the situation in Syria as two Navy destroyers launching Tomahawk missiles, 59 of them, into Syria, hitting an air base there, the air base that we believe was used to launch the gas attacks on civilians in Syria by the Assad regime. I've got to tell you, his father, Hafez Assad, who has died years ago, was a brutal dictator. This one wasn't. He was in the medical field. He was, and I believe, an ophthalmologist. And everybody thought, oh my gosh, Syria is going to be better off, but it apparently is not. The big concern right now is what will Russia do with this situation, as they are allies with the Assad regime. Now we're going live to South Korea. We're going to be talking with Michael Breen. He's a writer and consultant. He first went to Korea as a correspondent back in 1982. He covered the North and South Korea areas for several newspapers, including The Guardian in the United Kingdom, The Times, and The Washington Times. He lives in Seoul, South Korea as well. His new book is called The New Koreans. And Michael, let's go to you live in South Korea. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Thank you for spending some time with us tonight on a very important subject. We, of course, are going to get into your work and how South Korea has propelled itself as a nation. But I want to get your reaction to what's going on out there with the tension of North Korea, their missile testing, their launches, and this whack job who's running North Korea. What's the mood of the South Koreans, Michael, with that situation?
Well, you know, it may seem strange to say. I mean, obviously, government and defense people are, you know, watching closely, taking it seriously. But it may seem strange to say, but this is one of those issues where the closer you are to it, the less you pay attention to it. So the focus of attention right now is the China-U.S. summit. And a lot of the tough talk is coming out of the U.S. The big concern here would be if we did something that caused an overreaction by the North Koreans. The missile testing bothers us, but frankly, the South Korean people have other things on their mind right now.
Now, today's action against the Syrians, where we launched 59 Tomahawk missiles there, do you think this is also a wake-up call to Kim Jong-un, and we're trying to let him know, hey, we mean business here. Stop what you're doing.
Let's hope it is. I mean, it should be. He should be taking note of this and be scared by it. I know that going way back to the first Gulf War, the North Koreans watched that very, very closely and took note. But I think in the last sort of two or three decades, they've come to feel that the U.S. would not risk the unintended consequences of doing something similar against them. I think there's a certain confidence there that we don't have the stomach for it. And, you know, in order to do something like that, we'd need Chinese approval, we'd need Japanese approval, that might be the easiest, and we'd need South Korean approval, which is pretty unlikely to be given. So I think they're sort of confident that, I'm sure that they're thinking that right now this is all rhetoric.
Yeah.
And that we're going to come around and approach them in some other way, probably propose talks of some sort.
Have you had an opportunity to get into North Korea, maybe interview him at all?
Not for a long time. When I was a journalist, I went to North Korea several times and also interviewed the leader at that time, which is his grandfather. But I haven't been there for a long time. They tell me it hasn't changed.
when you compare the two Koreas, the South and the North, which is the most progressive? I mean, the North seems to have a pretty darn good military, and they're doing what they're doing. Yet, after reading your book, The New Koreans, you've seen just an incredible upsurge in the South. But how would you rate the two countries compared to each other, Michael?
What's the best way to rate them? I mean, the Koreans were unified roughly along their current border, you know, that border with China,
yeah,
for about 1,300 years. And the division into two countries happened 70 years ago. So they're kind of the same people. I mean, it makes a fascinating academic study of how one half of a country can go one way and the other half can go the other way. But you can't compare these. So this is like comparing Italy and Ethiopia. You know, South Korea is the world's 11th largest economy. It is a democracy. North Korea is one of the most barbaric dictatorships in the world. Its economy is in a shambles. And even the military, I mean, I'm sure that if it came to it, the South Koreans, without American help, could defeat the North Koreans without too much trouble.
I see. See, my prediction is, and watch this happen, Michael, this is my gut tells me that the military within North Korea, they don't want a war. They don't want to have to fight us or the South. They're going to take him out on their own. That's my guess. What do you think of that?
I think that's very likely. I think, the bit that we don't know, frankly, is the extent to which the leader up there is actually directing everything, or whether there's a bit of a collective decision-making.
Right.
And it's the military that wants to keep testing. You know, in order to perfect your weapons systems, you have to test them. So the military wants to have this full nuclear capability. But if he looks as if he's going to get them into a war, I'm sure they'll get rid of him.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay.
I think you're absolutely right.
So let us talk about this incredible book of yours, The New Koreans. And now, are you living there full-time now in South Korea?
Yeah.
Okay.
By the way, I have a personal interest in whether we attack North Korea or not, because I live, you know, about a 30-minute drive south of the border.
Oh, boy. You had that?
There's about 25 million other people alongside me, so you've got to bear that in mind.
How long have you been living there?
Since 1982.
All right. So you went there on assignment and just fell in love with the place, I take it.
Kind of. I didn't even have an assignment. I sort of came almost with a backpack on and didn't take it off for about 5 years. And then I thought, okay, I like this place. I was actually on my way to Hong Kong at the time, and I thought I'd stop here for a while and never left.
It was, when I think of South Korea, I think of Samsung, the telephone company, and of course they had their issues with their new phones, but apparently they've got some newer ones coming out that are much better. And the situation with their former president, who they have ousted and arrested. What was that all about?
Sorry, could you say that again? The phone just did a burp on me.
Oh, all right. I was talking about my inner knowledge of South Korea is the huge company Samsung and their telephone business. But also, I wanted to get your reaction to the South Korean president, the former president, the one that they've ousted, and she's been arrested. What happened there?
Good question. if you read the stories about that, they're all about, her getting ousted and getting put behind bars, but none of them are very clear on what she's supposed to have done. It's difficult to know where to start on this, because let's compare it to Watergate, for example.
All right.
The Watergate process that ended with Richard Nixon preempting impeachment by resigning took, I forget what it was now, it was like 18 months or 2 years. A
couple of years, yeah.
Yeah, because there's, you know, in America, however much, I mean, there's politics and there's law, and these things are distinct. So you know, half the country is going to be against the president, any president at the best of times. But there had to be a certain fairness here, investigations, figuring out what was wrong, the story kind of came out, emerged, that, you know, he'd done this, he'd done that. This all takes a bit of time. What happens here is slightly different. And it's because of the, in my opinion, the level of maturity of democracy. It's that there was a television program that showed some evidence that the president had a friend that nobody knew about, who the program said was basically controlling her and telling her what to do. That was it. That was all we knew. A million people came out in the street that weekend, holding candles, and very peacefully, but very vigorously, protesting against her. And in this country, which used to be an authoritarian, you know, it was always authoritarian, it was a dictatorship, the dictators left, and into the vacuum has moved this sort of idea of the people. The institutions of democracy are still a little bit weak. So the idea that when the people speak very clearly, the institutions then do their bidding. So what happened then is the National Assembly, which is equivalent of the you know, Congress, impeached her. Why? Because there were a million people on the street protesting against her. They had to sort of do something for reasons, because nothing had become clear yet. This is all based on television stories. And then the Constitutional Court rejected 4 out of 5 of the arguments, but accepted one. And that was enough to impeach her. And the one said that she had allowed her friend to use her name to shake down the conglomerates, including Samsung, which
they all paid up too.
Yeah, but everybody denies that. The money was for foundations to promote. One was to promote culture, the other was to promote sports. Now, all these foundations are funded by Samsung and the others anyway.
Sure.
So, what made this different? We don't know yet. Nothing's been proved. So the prosecution is desperately trying to prove that the whole rationale behind this impeachment is actually valid.
That'll be an interesting watching that unfold.
It's still playing out.
Yeah.
But she's behind bars right now, a pending trial.
So South Korea 20-some years ago was a very impoverished nation, and it was just nothing was working well for them. What happened? How was this planned out, and how have they become one of the world's, you know, highest grossing economies? What happened?
Well, it's the question, and it's a fascinating one. Just to give you a bit of perspective, in 1948, when the country, the two Koreas were officially established, and the UN was established, and Israel was founded, all that time.
Because at that time, during World War II, it was Japan that controlled Korea, right?
That's right. I mean, for up until 45, for 40 years, Korea was a kind of colony of Japan. Then it got liberated, but the U.S. and the Soviets occupied different zones, and then those zones ended up becoming separate countries.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the South Koreans, according to United Nations figures, ranked alongside Haiti and Ethiopia.
Oh, my God.
The world's poorest nations, well below Pakistan, country like that. This was a time when the promising economies in Asia were the Philippines and Burma. Not even Japan was a mess after the war. And then, 2 years later, then you had the Korean War, which just pulverized the place.
And the North came down into the South, and the Russians backed it, of course, the Chinese backed it. What was the reason for the attack? What did they want to accomplish? Did they just want to gobble up South Korea?
Yeah, I think, bearing in mind that the country had been divided in two just 18 months, and neither side, no Koreans accepted that.
They didn't like that.
They didn't like that. And the communists in the north possibly were misled by the southern communists into thinking that there is a view that the North Korean leader, Kim Il-sung, really thought that he'd be welcomed in the south. All he had to do would invade and it would just fall over.
Sounds like Ho Chi Minh and North Korea and South Korea.
Well, yeah, I think it's
very similar.
Yeah, very similar situation. And except that the U.S. came back, and after a terrible 3 years, the status quo was sort of pretty much the same as it had started. So here's the difference. The Koreans were, I think to answer your question, why did they develop? You know, you look at policies and things like that, but that's not it. It's what's behind that. What makes some countries, what made America become the extraordinary country it is? What made Britain at one point dominate the world? There's sort of a way of thinking and a sense of manifest destiny. The Koreans, I believe, were an enraged people. They were defiant. Their history, this is a time in the 1940s, a lot of the world was very modern, but they were a backward peasant country, bullied, just come out of colonialism. Their whole history was one of bullying. So their history had delivered them to, had given them nothing. So they were furious about this. They were furious at the North Koreans for invading them, furious at the North Koreans claimed to be the superior Koreans, because most intellectuals were attracted to communism at that time, socialism. So the South Koreans didn't feel good about themselves. The world looked down on them.
Then it was a horrible war. We lost as Americans 36,000 troops there, and the Koreans lost far more, and civilian deaths were astronomical.
They're huge, yeah. And Chinese as well, funny enough. The Chinese lost a lot. And so the Koreans eventually, I think that was factor number one, a kind of a fury. But their first president was useless. The second factor is leadership. So their second president, a military dictator, who's the father of this president we're talking about, who's in jail now, he harnessed this fury and this defiance. He put a hard hat on it and he sent it to work in factories. And the way he did this is quite extraordinary. The Koreans didn't have a blueprint. They didn't sort of get a bunch of American advisors to come in. Okay, how do we develop?
Yeah, they didn't map this out, did they?
No, they didn't map it out. The leader said, he was a dictator, so he could do this. He set a vision. Okay, our goal in 5 years is to become a country that exports $100 million worth of exports.
Hold on, Michael. We're going to take a break right now, but we are going to come right back and we'll pick that up. Michael Breen with us, his book, The New Koreans. We'll be back right after the top of the hour, and we'll also open up the phone lines.